This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I am Gaius, John Batchelor, and I welcome my colleague Germanicus, Mark of Lejos, by the Thames, Londinium, 90 AD, speculating about the lessons of empire. We are Romans, equestrian class. We understand that the might of Rome settles all disputes. However, we're lucky enough to live under the shadow of the genius of Augustus, the god Augustus, and we know ahead of us is a second century of Roman majesty. After that, it becomes dodgier. We're looking 20 centuries ahead to the 21st century. We have this authority, drinking our cups of wine, to imagine outcomes for the conflict in Europe. We're Europeans, but right now we're mostly Romans, Roman Europeans. In 20 centuries, Europe will be at war with itself. It begins in Ukraine, but it extends into all parts of prosperous Europe and aspirational Europe, and then across the map of Eurasia, the world island of China. We've been debating this for some weeks, and now we turn to the matter of negotiations between the powers and their subordinates' powers. Washington, Dateline, New York Times. A day after President Biden said he would be willing to talk with President Putin of Russia about a possible peace agreement in Ukraine, the Kremlin offered a frosty response, and prospects for settling the brutal conflict remain as distant as ever. Rather than pursue the details of this particular exchange, Germanicus has agreed to speculate what this means when you start to talk about talks. It can be that the context here is armistice. That's not the same as peace. That's not the same as a treaty. That's a ceasefire that can be broken at any moment. There have been instances in the 20th century and the 19th century of the powers coming to this moment where they start to talk about talks, and then they pull back, and then they talk again. Germanicus, a very good evening to you. Talking about talks, in reviewing it with you in our conversation on the way to the Thames to enjoy our cup of wine, I was struck by two instances I'm familiar with. Christmas of 1916, following Woodrow Wilson's re-election, very close re-election over Charles Evans Hughes, and the European powers, through the offices of Colonel House, who was spending a lot of time going between the capitals in Europe, European powers looked to Wilson to arbitrate in some fashion an armistice, what eventually would happen after the U.S. entered the war, and after the final offensive that broke the German armies and sent them reeling back to the across the Rhine. However, in 1916, the German armies were poised. Verdun had exhausted both the French army and the German army. And as of yet, Russia was still in the war. So there was a moment here where both sides could imagine victory, unless there was a way of finding a ceasefire and armistice. Now, we know what followed was a British offensive, the Third Battle of Wipers, Ypres, which I think we remember as Passchendaele, that effectively ended the British Expeditionary Force. They were out of manpower after that. The French army, we know, would mutiny in the summer of 1917. This is all ahead of us. Wilson was given an opportunity to arbitrate. He was turned away. We're not quite sure why, except for both sides thought there was victory. Berlin still thought they could win. Paris still thought they could win. Is that where we are in this talk about talks right now? Do both sides believe they can win? I mention one more detail. The second time I can come up with an example where the armistice talk was significant was the fall of 1972, when Henry Kissinger in Paris emerged from conversation with the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong in a four-sided table and said, peace is at hand. What followed was violence comparable in that terms of that war to Passchendaele, to the French rebellion of the summer of 1917. So I have two instances in the 20th century where talk about talks led to more violence. Is that where we are, or can this be that exception? Talk about talks leads to peace. Good evening to you.
Good evening, Gaius. The armistice talking about talking phase is obscured by being more than what it appears to be. In other words, the very fact that one party or maybe both parties raise the possibility of a settlement or even more modestly of an armistice is in itself an indicator of how those parties look at their prospects for victory. And this means that too eager an initiation of talking to talk is in many ways an admission that your enemy is perhaps desperate and wants a peace because he knows he's not going to win in the end. And therefore, the talking about talk is an opportunity for intelligence gathering and analysis that might shade the overall net assessment that the belligerent parties have toward each other. And so it's very hard to pin down whether or not the parties are sincere in any way. Moreover, passage of talking that leads to a serious negotiation is a passage that is going to be inevitably conditioned by the actual dynamics, power dynamics, between the parties that seek to negotiate. This doesn't mean the power dynamics going on the front necessarily, but the larger power dynamics and goals of each of the parties. So the Wilson peace offer was heavily conditioned in the eyes of both the Central Powers and the Allies by the fact that the U.S. was the key force undergirding the Allied cause. It was providing the loans, the munitions, and thus the sinews of war. And therefore, the British and French, and of course, to a lesser extent, the Russians, who were beginning to unravel at that point, they asked themselves whether they would really want to have Wilson broker a peace, in large part because Wilson himself was already swept up with a vision of the U.S. as the arbiter of the world. And that was clear enough to the British and French, so that having Wilson engaged in providing munitions and loans was preferable to the risk of making peace, where the fate of Britain and France would to some extent depend upon the choices of Woodrow Wilson, as it indeed turned out eventually when the actual armistice occurred, which turned both Britain and France into vassals of the U.S. The U.S. entry to the war, which ensured Allied victory, had a huge downside, not as great a downside, one might argue, as what Germany suffered. But there was plenty of reason for Britain and France to want to keep the situation they had and not give it over to the hands of a risky and not necessarily trustworthy partner when the current situation was just fine. And that current situation could well develop into the U.S. entering the war, a state of belligerency on the side of the Allies, which would be a consummation devoutly to be wished, and which, after all, happened just several months after the House talks. Also, Germany was in a situation where there were still opportunities to be had in the East. They had just briefly relieved the German people of their hunger pains by conquering Romania and taking all of its food. And also, they could see how overstretched and weakened the Russian Empire was and how close Russia was to unraveling. And they had their own plans and contingencies, namely the person of Mr. Lenin himself, that they could insert into that unraveling situation. Moreover, as we would see just a few months later, the Italian front seemed to dissolve in 1917 at the Battle of Caporetto. And this was a situation that wasn't absolutely dire yet. It would get that way in 1918, but it wasn't there yet. And in fact, there were reasons to believe Germany could still win. So this wasn't really a congenial situation. And the third party was not really trusted by any of the belligerents. Now, we can compare that to the situation that existed in March of this year when Russia and the Ukraine entered into negotiations. And the U.S. Buoyed in a very presumptive way by the successful Ukrainian defense of their homeland, sent Boris Johnson to speak to Mr. Zelensky, and he said, no negotiations. We're going to win this one. We think you can win. And he saluted as a loyal client, and the war continued. And then the war began to reverse. And now Russia is in a dominant, near dominant situation. It's not yet dominant because the dominance has yet to be revealed, but it will be shortly. And there is the glimmering of awareness, if not much more than just a glimmer or gleam in our eyes, of a debacle unfolding in the coming months in Ukraine. And so now the U.S. wants to engage in negotiations, but the U.S. is in a very weak position, having laid out an absolutely inflexible set of demands on Russia. It's very difficult for the U.S. to pull back from those demands, and it is even more difficult to go to the electorates of the U.S. and NATO and tell them, this inevitable Ukrainian victory, as U.S. officials and former officials have been promising since March, is maybe not going to happen. And then there's the impending winter and the lack of energy and the flood of refugees, a second huge wave of refugees waiting in the wings, depending on what happens in the winter battle. All of this could spell disaster for the U.S., but Russia is now in a position where it can lay down the terms, and the U.S. is not yet in a position where it is willing to move toward accepting them. So if we could compare it historically, a good example would be the Russo-Turkish War of 1877-78. And after breaking through at places like Plevna and other really bloody battles, the Russian army had reached the gates of Constantinople. And the war was about to end on Russian terms. Then the British intervened. The British sailed through the Dardanelles with their gleaming ironclads and leveled their guns at the Russian lines. And Russia, however close to victory it was in this war, was in a position not dissimilar to that the U.S. is in facing Russia. Except this time, Russia would be entering into a second Crimean War, with Britain and France certain to devastate Russia and defeat it again. And so even though they were on the cusp of victory, they agreed to an armistice and an end to the war, which favored Russia, of course, and did not favor the Ottomans, but preserved the Ottomans, which were, that their dynasty was about to collapse. So we're in a position now where we at some point are going to have to make a decision. Do we pull back and back down? Or do we escalate in the face of a powerful Russian offensive in Ukraine? That offensive hasn't been unleashed yet. But if it were to be unleashed and it were to be successful, and Ukraine was in extremis, we would be essentially abandoning the cause that we swore so urgently to defend forever, as long as it takes, said the American president. And so this is a very difficult situation, but it is not one where armistice is waiting in the wings, and not even where serious discussions, talking about talking, are going to happen.
We have observers of these matters, Germanicus. That would be the 27 members of the European Union. And I want to turn to those doubters, because they are right now weakening each day. As the winter approaches, as the winter of 23 approaches, as the winter of 24 approaches, this is going to take some time for this to settle in Europe. I'm speaking to Germanicus Makovleos. We are in Londinium in 90 AD, 2,000 years safe from the violence of the 21st century. But we have examples of the last 200 years before the 21st century where talking about talk led to more violence. Is that possible here? And what about the European Union? Can they wait out this dance? This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.